This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Turkeys are synonymous with Thanksgiving. Two-thirds of the farm-raised birds eaten each year in the U.S. come from just six states. And farm-raised turkeys are often preferable to eating over wild ones. Did you know at one time there were no wild turkeys left in Connecticut? Coming up, we're going to hear how they made a comeback. That's later. First, are you one among those who were left shaking your head after Amazon announced it's building its two new headquarters in two of the largest metro areas on the East Coast? The incentives New York City and Virginia are shelling out to the tech giant are harder to swallow, to the tune of $2.5 billion. Today, Where We Live, we're going to take a look at corporate welfare. Later, we'll look at the incentives Connecticut has awarded to companies over the last 8 years. Now, first, an investigation by CityLab caught our eye over a practice that's turned up in at least 21 states, and it centers on the property taxes big box stores like Walmart or Target pay to municipalities. Joining us with more is Laura Bliss. She's staff writer at CityLab. Laura, welcome back to our show.
Thanks so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
And you can join our conversation, too. How do you feel about corporate welfare? Do you think that states and municipalities are giving away too much to attract businesses who end up getting too much in return in terms of tax breaks and other incentives? That number to join us, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, Laura, you were reporting on a strategy that many of us probably haven't heard about, this thing called dark store theory, which is having an impact on the revenue being collected by cities and towns. Tell us, what is dark store theory?
Yeah, happy to explain. And first, I'll just kind of contextualize it. I think, you know, we definitely spoke to a number of folks in the process of reporting the story who sort of made the connection to the kind of corporate welfare, as you describe it. And in some ways, there's definitely deep connections in this kind of practice. But in other ways, it's sort of the flip side. While, you know, communities are in many cases kind of rolling out the red carpet and you know, handing out extra benefits to try to bring businesses to town, this is actually how some of the most familiar retail brands in the country are also actively trying to reduce the amount that they are paying to those localities, so cities and counties. So to explain, dark store theory is this kind of ominous-sounding term that city tax assessors, you know, who, if you own a home, you'll be very familiar, right? You get a property tax bill every year that comes from the city assessor's office, who decides how much your building is worth. So dark store theory is this kind of legal argument that big box retailers, including Walmart, Target, Home Depot, Lowe's, Meijer, Menards, those are sort of more in the Midwest, are using to say, hey, city tax assessor, you're doing this way wrong. In fact, the value of our brick-and-mortar retail locations should actually be worth, in many cases, they're saying, about half as much as these cities are saying it is. And the argument that they're making essentially stems from the number of vacant and in many cases sort of rehabilitated or second-generation big box stores that are sort of sprinkled across the retail landscape.
So when a store like a Lowe's or Home Depot comes in, oftentimes there may be nothing in a particular location and they could build up from scratch, or they might fill an old plaza that's been sitting there from some time. And so in your reporting, you found that in certain states, some of these big box retailers were coming back to their city assessors and saying, we're actually being charged too much in property tax. We should be compared to a vacant store and not what we have today.
Yeah, year after year after year. So I'll just kind of take a few concrete examples maybe. So this practice, this dark store theory phenomena, has really been focused, concentrated in the upper Midwest. So Michigan has really been hit hard in terms of the impact to city tax revenues. And currently Wisconsin is really sort of fighting at the local level with what to do with these kind of incessant property tax appeals. So for example, one city I visited, Wauwatosa, which is a suburb of Milwaukee actually has about 6 active disputes with retail locations who are all making some version of this argument. So, and not just for 1 year of property assessment, but for multiple years in a row. So, for example, Lowe's, Meijer, an entire mall, a Nordstrom, a Best Buy, they're all making claims that their property should be valued at about half as much. Kind of varies a little bit. So just for example, that Lowe's, right, the city currently values it at $13.6 million. They're arguing they should be valued at $7. Again, for this argument is sort of based off of other locations sprinkled throughout the region in many cases that are vacant or that have been sort of repurposed and given a sort of second life that city assessors say is kind of crazy to compare to a Lowe's store that might be one of the most successful in the region.
This is Where We Live. On the phone with me, Laura Bliss, staff writer at CityLab. We're talking about her recent investigation into a practice known as dark store theory, where certain big box retailers in certain parts of the country are appealing their assessments to the towns or cities where they're located to pay less in property tax. This is something that you said has been an issue more in the Midwest. Why is that, Laura?
It's a really good question. I think that we can say that the practice really seemed to gain speed in Michigan, which was one of the sort of hardest hit states in that region by the recession. So sort of think about where this all originated, right? 2008, we had this economic collapse, and combined with other forces that have been kind of transforming our shopping habits, right? We're sort of moving towards online retail, and there might be other kinds of preferences that are coming up. Consumer spending, has gone kind of up and down over the last decade, and there's been a pretty noticeable impact, right, to many of the retail chains that remain some of the most familiar, and that continues, right, just this past year. We've seen Toys R Us, declare bankruptcy. We've seen announcements of store closures from Sears and Kmart and others. And so Michigan and also Wisconsin, have been pretty hard hit by that. And so what this kind of larger retail landscape created was an opening, I think, for tax lawyers to say, okay, well, wait, all of these properties around the region are vacant or have been repurposed for, uses that are much less valuable than, the big box store kind of highest and best use, to use a little bit of tax assessor lingo. So these stores, even the ones that are in business, should be significantly less valuable. And I just want to sort of highlight too. We're getting into the nitty gritty of the kind of argument here, and it's complex. But the thing to focus on here is really the impact, right? So Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, right? That town I mentioned, that could potentially, lose out to these 6 disputes, would owe more than $22 million in tax refunds to those 6 stores if they were all successful. And then that's in addition to the decline in tax revenue that they would be looking at year after year after year.
When you talk about decline in revenue that cities and towns would see if some of these cases, and they have been argued successfully in court, so you could see a reduction in the town services from funding libraries to even police?
That's right. I mean, the thing that many assessors in Wisconsin, which is really the state that I focused on, really stressed is that, in Wisconsin, every state is a little bit different, right, in terms of how it handles property taxes, but there is this property tax levy cap, which means that to make up the kind of gap in lost tax revenue, what city assessors could do is shift some of that onto residential homeowners, right? If it was kind of a decision between cutting essential services and trying to sort of figure out how to make up that gap. So there was an analysis by the Wisconsin League of Municipalities which is an organization there that, that sort of advocates and represents city officials, and they took an average across seven different cities that are facing this dark store theory issue and found that the average homeowner could wind up paying an extra $385 a year in property taxes if these dark store appeals were widely successful.
Now, Laura, in your reporting, you actually tried to survey if this practice was happening in different states, and you heard from 21 different states. Can you walk us through some of those court cases that have been successful towards the big box retailer that says that the way a town assesses their property is not fair?
Yeah, so it's quite a mixed landscape in terms of what courts are saying. So just to kind of walk through, like, what exactly the chain of events is here, right? So anybody who owns property, and that includes homeowners, right, has the right to appeal their property taxes. And generally speaking, certainly in Wisconsin, you know, the way that you do that is you file an appeal, you submit some paperwork to the city or you know, in other states, it might be the county assessor. And then generally speaking, you know, most of the assessors I spoke to in Wisconsin said that their practice, you know, they try to be sort of as conservative as possible. And so if there's a property owner who has, you know, a good reason that their, you know, valuation should be a little bit different, right? I mean, some homeowners might be familiar with this, like, you know, maybe the city property tax bill one year missed the fact that you made some renovations or you put a new swimming pool or you took it out. And so your property is maybe worth a little bit different than they're saying. So this is perfectly legal, right? And in many cases, the city will try to settle for somewhere in the middle of the two values. But because these dark store theory appeals are so out of whack, in fact, with what assessors say is general practice, and because retail locations, you know, retailers keep coming back year after year after year asking for further reductions, in some cases even after they've been given reductions in their property values and therefore, you know, reductions in the taxes that they're paying. They're increasingly saying, okay, no, we're not going to keep just settling. We're going to kick this up to, you know, a circuit court. And in some cases, this has even got up further to the state Supreme Court in Michigan and Indiana. Have all heard dark store theory related cases. There's another one on the schedule in Oregon, actually. So this is really spreading. And it seems to me that it's about half and half. So some judges that are hearing about this case are, you know, quite sympathetic, in fact, to the plight of Walmart and, you know, Menards and Meijer and these kinds of big box retailers who are making this claim. And in other cases, judges are saying, you know, kind of sticking to the side of the municipalities and kind of hearing out, you know, their argument, which is that, hey, actually, you know, property assessment is really complicated. It's not as simple as kind of pointing around to other properties in this case and saying, you know, here's how much this one's worth. So it's really split. And, you know, another sort of track towards resolution on this issue has been, you know, through state legislatures. So likewise in Michigan and also in Indiana, and now in Wisconsin, there are some attempts to resolve this through changes in the state law. But there too, there's quite a lot of lobbying pressure from, you know, groups that represent retailers. So it's really not clear which way this is heading.
We got a comment from a listener that says a story in Connecticut magazine actually focused in on the money that municipalities are losing with these tax appeals involving big retail companies like Target and Walmart, also Stop and Shop, which is a grocery chain here in New England. What are the ramifications and how this might, I guess, go forward in terms of not just looking at big box retailers, but are towns and municipalities worried about other types of businesses coming forth with these types of appeals, Laura?
Yes. And just to kind of distill the issue one more way, I realize this is complicated, and I hope any listeners who are interested in the story will check it out on CityLab, because I think it's explained probably more clearly there than I've been able to here. But the basic dispute here, you know, while the impact to city revenues is really, really clear, in fact, there is, I think, a legitimate dispute happening about how to value a property, especially a property like a big box store where there has been so much change in the market recently. And, you know, experts in property tax I spoke to say, you know, this is a serious debate that's happening, and it needs to be resolved one way or the other. And there absolutely is a fear that, you know, well, oh my gosh, like if the sort of basic fundamental strategies that city assessors use are being challenged in a way that is gaining some traction and some success in the eyes of courts, well then, you know, what really is stopping other kinds of properties from, kind of taking up this argument too, you know, whether it's industrial properties or, fast food restaurants, or office buildings or hospitals or corporate headquarters, right? Anything that is kind of like an unusual type of property could plausibly make this claim, and in some places they are. So that could spell pretty serious fiscal chaos for small towns.
Again, on the phone with me is Laura Bliss, a staff writer for City Lab. Again, looking into this practice known as dark store theory, a practice where certain big box retailers are appealing their assessments, and in some states actually winning these appeals, which results in dramatic reductions in the types of property tax amounts that a town or a city can collect. Since doing your story, Laura, because we talk often about corporate welfare, what have been some of the readers' comments or feedback about this practice?
Yeah, well, I've been really encouraged to see that, you know, this issue is not actually all that easy to understand for all the reasons you've been talking about, and it's also not that easy to surface because, you know, most of these property tax appeals happen at the very local level, and there's not necessarily documentation of it, and so it did take some doing to sort of figure out, okay, where is this spreading, and what are the communities that are really being impacted. So I've been quite encouraged to see that I've had readers from Colorado and Massachusetts and elsewhere sort of reaching out and asking, you know, we put together sort of a national map about where this is happening, and folks have reached out to learn more. So that's encouraging because I think it is an issue that needs more reporting on. And yeah, I mean, another kind of connection that's there, and to circle back to the start of the conversation, is that, you know, for many city officials and leaders that I spoke with, you know, they describe this practice as like kind of a betrayal, right? You know, these are towns that in many cases did offer benefits and tax breaks of different kinds to the stores to bring them into town, right? West Bend, Wisconsin, another community about an hour north of Milwaukee, spent like $16 million improving what was vacant farmland to bring in the Menards, which is like a Home Depot sort of chain, and a Walmart, that are now disputing their assessments and saying those buildings that they occupy should be worth about 50% less, which could be a really big challenge for West Bend as it still continues to try to pay down that investment it made just for them. So I think, you know, to your earlier point, it does kind of connect to this broader conversation that has really been sparked up by the Amazon HQ2 saga and, you know, what cities have done to sort of bring this enormous employer to town and the kind of pros and cons that are a part of that.
And you had touched on this earlier, Laura, again, these ideas since the recession, a lot of these retailers have had to close depending on where they're located with the emergence of the online giants like Amazon. There's also repercussions there when people aren't going to brick and mortar stores to purchase their products anymore.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. It's a sort of dark corner of a rapidly changing landscape that we've been, I think that there's been a national conversation about for many years.
Laura Bliss, again, is a staff writer at City Lab. We're going to tweet out a link to her story at Where We Live. Laura, thanks so much for, explaining this complicated story, and we look forward to speaking with you again.
Thanks so much, Lucy.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Now, coming up, there's been a lot of scrutiny over the years over how the state of Connecticut has incentivized certain businesses to move or stay here. Hearst Connecticut's Dan Haar will join us with some analysis of these deals, and we want to hear from you. Do you want your tax dollars used to attract big businesses to Connecticut or to get them to stay? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. So Connecticut had an offer to Amazon to try and lure the tech giant to build one of its headquarters here. But the State Freedom of Information Commission recently ruled the state's exempt from disclosing the incentives in its failed bid. That's according to a report from the Meriden Record Journal after the newspaper filed a complaint. Now, Amazon in Hartford or in Stamford proved to be a long shot in the end after the company announced it chose Queens and Arlington, Virginia. But has the state's strategy to lure or keep companies here been successful over the last 8 years? For more analysis, we're joined in studio by Dan Haar, who's a columnist and associate editor for Hearst Connecticut Media. Dan, welcome to our show.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
So tell us, when we think about Amazon's decision to build its two East Coast headquarters in Queens and Arlington, did Connecticut ever stand a chance?
Absolutely not. Under no circumstances did Connecticut stand a chance. First of all, because we know in the end that Amazon wasn't interested in helping any jurisdiction. That was ridiculous. They were going to go to New York and Washington all along. A lot of people thought Atlanta, perhaps. There were some rumors about Charlotte. But it was clearly going to be a place that had major airport facilities. Southern Connecticut does not have that. Hartford area would have been a slightly better fit, I think, in terms of, you know, airport and space and land available. But again, they were looking all along at a magnet city, and there are six or seven magnet cities in the country, and we don't have one.
What about Stamford? I mean, Stamford has a lot going for it, but is it the gridlock and its proximity to New York that can be not something that Amazon would have even considered?
Keep naming factors, and I'll just keep saying yes. The airport was a deal killer. I think gridlock happens everywhere, but of course you have in Long Island City, you can have people living there a little bit more easily. I shouldn't say living with public transportation a little bit more easily, but the airport was the deal killer. The fact that Stamford's an edge city to New York. And so they were not looking to be in edge cities. They were looking to be in cities, or at least on the edge of the very edge of cities. So that's where they are, and God bless them. And as you see in New York, some of the people, especially Democrats, are unhappy about the amount spent. They are saying $48,000 per job. Amazon is saying that that's what they're spending. Good Jobs First, which is the watchdog private nonprofit that looks at these deals, is saying $112,000 per job for a total of $4.6 billion. And it's all spelled out. So I tend to believe them.
So when we think about economic developments, a lot of the focus the last 8 years, depending on which side of the aisle you're on, is whether the deals that under Governor Malloy's administration have actually been a good thing for the state, trying to lure certain companies. We know there have been some successes, but also some failures. You've been covering this for a long time, Dan. How would you rate the economic deals that the state has put out there?
Like democracy, it's the worst system in the world, and the only thing worse is not having it. It's a game that states have to play. Every single candidate, and I just wrote a column about this, without any exception, without any party exception, Oz Griebel, the petitioning candidate, Democrats, Republicans, all said, we're going to get away from this. We're going to get away from this. It doesn't make sense to bribe companies. It makes sense to build up our infrastructure and make companies want to be here. And that's great rhetoric on the campaign trail. Every state is involved in incentives for companies. It's a game you cannot get out of. And Connecticut has generally been mid to upper middle of the pack. Early years of the Malloy administration, there were some much bigger deals. Jackson Labs was a good deal, but controversial because of the cost per job. Generally speaking, it's just simply part of the game. The failures in Connecticut have been not so much big companies taking the money and running as the deals not working out. And Alexion was the most prominent of those. It was initially a First Five program. First Five is the bigger company incentives. And there have been 19 of them, not including Alexion, that didn't work out. So they moved their headquarters to Boston, gave the money back, and that's the way it's worked.
So because we got the money back, is that still considered a failure, Dan?
I don't know. It's like a metaphysical question. I think in Small Business Express, which to me is the more – that's about 1,000 companies a year. And there are grants and loans totaling – let's say $50,000 or maybe even less to $100,000 or $200,000. And that is, in my mind, there are two categories of those incentives to those small businesses. One is companies that bring in revenues from the outside, and the other is companies that are what I call the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker that are here anyway, retail or you know, companies that serve this area. And those are the ones that, in my view, should not get any money. Some of those have failed, and that in those cases, the money simply disappears. But that's not big money. Connecticut is spending a lot of money on this. For the most part, it is generating the jobs that these programs say. It's a pretty high success rate. And I look at the numbers, and you know, we're spending in the range of $175 to $200 million a year on giving incentives to companies. And they are tending to create jobs at a rate of about $20,000 to $25,000 a job. I know you're going to get called, oh, Jackson Labs is $1 million a job. But for the most part, that's the range. And the idea is that when you do an economic analysis, the taxes paid by those individuals, those employees, over a relatively short period of years pays back the fiscal cost of investing in it. And so in that sense, it works. In that sense.
You're hearing Dan Haar, who's a columnist and associate editor for Hearst Connecticut Media. This is Where We Live, as we look again at some of the incentives that the state of Connecticut has given to companies to either try to get them to come here or to retain them. We know this was a hot topic during the governor's election. You can join the conversation. How do you want your tax dollars used? Do you think it's a smart way to keep companies here for job creation and to help with tax revenue, too? The number 860-275-7266. Dan, you referenced your column where you said that this incentive package is part of any governor's toolbox, period. But then you also give a little history on how it all got started here in Connecticut. So tell us about, again, the administration of Lowell Weicker and how this became more common after that.
It was in, yes, as you said, Governor Weicker, Joe McGee, who's now at the Fairfield County Business Council, is the was the Economic Development Commissioner. And that was when they did some pretty big deals for the banks in Stamford. I believe RBS and UBS were then. I could be wrong about one, the other, or both. But generally, we trace the very large expansion. Not that there weren't deals before that under O'Neill, but the really large expansion started then. And it wasn't just Lowell Weicker and Joe McGee in Connecticut. It was happening all across the country at that time. This was a sort of new paradigm, is if you want companies, what when you really want to think about it as an economic phenomenon, you think that when we were kids, a lot of us were kids, people followed jobs. Right, people follow jobs. Where there, Pratt and Whitney came here during the World War II expansion, and 40,000 people worked in East Hartford, North Haven, which, by the way, is the site. The North Haven Pratt plant is now going to be the site of the Amazon third location in Connecticut, which was a $25 million. The records say 20, but it's up to $25 million incentive for Amazon, and Amazon has been doing this all over the country. So companies would come. And they would land where they land for whatever reasons that included whatever, and people would move there. Thousands and thousands of people moved to Connecticut to work at Pratt and Whitney in the 40s and beyond. The new paradigm in the 90s started to be jobs follow people. Companies go where people want to be, right? So my kid lives in Boston. She's going to be in Boston. That's where she wants to be. So jobs are going to follow her. And in order to get people to want to be in a place and jobs to want to be in a place, that's where the money started. And that really was the phenomenon that grew up in the 90s and has not only not abated, but has increased.
When we think about job creation, you know, something that we've heard from listeners, it's great if, say, Amazon is building a warehouse in the state of Connecticut. But how much are those jobs paying people?
The Amazon jobs pay better. We never see the actual amounts, but what we tend to see is what percent of retail. So when the Amazon announcement came out a year ago about North Haven and the old Pratt & Whitney plant, this you're talking 855,000 square feet, right? So that's a, you know, an acre is 42,000 square feet. So that's a lot of, it's a lot of building. 1,800 people, right? So Amazon's displacing a lot of retail jobs, as we obviously know, and as you talked about in the last segment. But those jobs pay 30% more than a typical retail warehouse job. What does that mean? It means that they're close to sustainable in Connecticut. You know, it's a tough state to be sustainable. But, I mean, I think that's a great question. The bottom line is that the companies would say, with the incentives, we're going to be able to pay more. And I think pay has generally been not part of the equation of debate. The debate has been payback, right? How fast do we get the money back? And the biggest question of all is not the formula, because DECD does put everything into what they call an input-output formula. You put it in, what do you get out? And the question really is more about, would they have done this anyway? Right, so it's the moral hazard. Do you pay money to somebody who would have done it anyway? And the biggest and most controversial example of that in Connecticut was Bridgewater Associates. Were you going to get to Bridge? Yeah, okay. Ask the question then.
So Governor Malloy got a lot of flack because of Bridgewater. And how much money did they get?
Up to $52 million. $22 million was the controversial portion, which is the loan. $30 million up to $30 in tax credits. And that was a First Five company. First Five is really just a fancy word for the first year. There were five, and there have been 19 so far, and they were the bigger deals. So very controversial, because Bridgewater at $169 billion was, and maybe still is, the largest hedge fund. And it's loaded with gazillionaires. And I've always said that that's exactly why this is the best deal Malloy ever did. There's very little more mobile than a financial services company that has laptops, you know, and they're all in the cloud anyway, right? So the cloud isn't in Connecticut. So maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but it doesn't matter. So 1,400 people at Bridgewater could pick up and move tomorrow. And obviously, it's harder than that, because they have an enormous expertise of people that live in Fairfield County. But it's not too terribly hard to evolve away from a place if you don't have giant machinery and so forth.
And what would Connecticut stand to lose if Bridgewater were to leave?
I can't even calculate it, because we don't know the salaries. But Ray Dalio's salary alone, one year he made $4.9 million, according to one of the hedge fund magazines. Billion dollars, right? So that's 49,000 people making $1 million each. So one person's pay makes up for the entire package. In a typical year, he may make $1 billion.
This is Where We Live. Again, Dan Haar's here as we reflect back on the economic incentives awarded under the Governor Malloy administration. You heard Dan mention First Five. There's also Small Business Express. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Before we talk about incoming Governor Ned Lamont, when we think about how states are competing against each other, this practice isn't going to go away anytime soon, right? Because if Connecticut were to say, you know what, we're not going to do this anymore, there's New York, there's Massachusetts. It would be a bad move for Connecticut.
Yeah, the big rap on General Electric moving from headquarters from Fairfield to Boston was, they moved, taxes were too high in Connecticut, and the incentives didn't mean anything in Connecticut. Well, they moved to a higher tax place, which is Boston, and they got $145 million to move 800 jobs. So that's a sort of upper middle of the pack incentive, and that's exactly an illustration of what we're talking about.
We got a Facebook comment from Sharon, who writes, we need another name for this. I think we were talking about corporate welfare, because it's not capitalism as we used to know it, literally bribing corporations to stay in business and to do it in a particular location, with the bribes paid for by the working classes. Joe on Twitter picks that up. Glad this is being talked about, as one of my members said the other day, Connecticut takes from the little guy to give to the big guy.
Well, the idea is the big guy hires the little guy. I don't think it works terribly well for the average person. But like I said, it's not a system that Connecticut can just simply pull out of. The myth that there's some kind of free market that these incentives are meddling with is, I find, comical. There is no such thing as a free market. The government is a third of the government of commerce, and that's the way it is. And so the government both sets the rules and is a customer and is a scale tipper, and that's just the way it is.
Dan, what kind of perspective do you think Ned Lamont is going to bring to the governor's office? We heard him talk a lot about emphasis that's coming to Hartford. What kind of deal did emphasis get? I believe it was up to $12 million in grants from DECD to reach certain job creation milestones.
Emphasis is a really good example of what we're talking about in respect to what Ned Lamont says he's going to do. Okay. Emphasis required a whole lot of outreach by Ned Lamont and his friend Indra Nooyi, who's the outgoing CEO of PepsiCo. Did she leave yet? Did she step down yet?
I think she did.
Yeah. Okay. So she through connections at Yale School of Management, where they both went, they knew the CEO of Infosys, who they cajoled to come up to Hartford. And the famous story that Ned has told many times is the driver of the car was bad-mouthing Hartford. And Indra Nooyi talks about when she came here in 1978 or 79 or 80 to go to Yale School of Management from India, the driver of that car said how great Connecticut was and how, you know, this is the best state. So this is what's changed in 40 years. Infosys required a lot of cooperation by the local CEOs and the local business executives in the Hartford area to really sit down and say, this is why this is a great place for you to be, not only because of the insurance industry, but because of other reasons as well. And that's what Ned Lamont is pushing. That's what he's saying. We're going to know these people. We're going to tell them why we're the better place. And if there's an incentive deal, oh, sure, but that won't be the primary thing. But, of course, $12 million is $12 million, and without it, it ain't happening.
When we hear so often about how Connecticut's broke, where does this money come from to incentivize these companies?
You and me. This is bonded money. That, again, I mentioned it's been a range of 100 and let's say 175 to, I believe it's been up to 250. But in the recent couple of years, let's say just under $200 million total. And that's bonded. And hypothetically, some of the money should be coming back. All of the money comes back to the general fund, according to the formulas. The question isn't, does the money come back? The question is, would it have come back anyway? But in terms of, it's not a revolving fund. In other words, the money doesn't come back to DECD. There are some revolving funds in the state apparatus, which we're not talking about. For the most part, the money comes into the general fund. And so it's bonded money. It's borrowed money. And it's not inexpensive, but it's also well worth it at rates of 3.25% that the state pays.
And when you say bonded money, so my children who are 3 and 7, if they continue to live in Connecticut, they're the ones that are going to be paying this bill.
Yeah, I'm sick and tired of us protecting our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I think we should just foist everything onto them, because I want to be able to sell my house. And so I want a state that functions well and, you know, let my daughter and her children and their children worry about it in the future. I'm being facetious, but the point is that that's really what we're doing when we mortgage a house as well.
What role does the General Assembly play in this at all?
General Assembly it hypothetically controls the money. As you know, bond money goes through the State Bond Commission, which the governor chairs. And traditionally, the governor has had a much stronger hand over bonded money than over regular operational spending in the state, which has to go through the arduous process of the legislative budget. Bonded money tends to be easier for the governor to move around.
We've been, again, focusing a lot on talking about this, given what happened with Amazon and their big marketing scheme to get as much attention as possible to choose two places that make sense for this tech giant. But Wisconsin actually lured a tech giant, Foxconn, to their state, and their incentive package is even larger than the one Amazon is getting.
Per job it is, I think. Well, it's larger, according to the official numbers, at the rate of $2 billion. I think it's 2.1. By the way, the largest ever was Boeing, $8.7 billion with a B, to stay in Seattle or near Seattle. That's just crazy numbers, but it's thousands and thousands of jobs, and they pay a lot of money, and they're manufacturing jobs, which is what people seem to want. Foxconn makes, I think, flat-screen TVs. Is that what it is there? It's electronics, in any case. And Foxconn was famous for some of the labor abuses in China working for Apple. And that big investigation in, I think, 2015. But Foxconn has come to Wisconsin at a rate of, what is it per job? It's $60,000, $70,000, and they're not that high-paying jobs. Most people think Wisconsin got the raw deal on that one.
Again, Dan Haar was with us from Hearst Connecticut Media as we talk about, again, economic deals and incentives. The state has to broker to keep certain companies here and try to attract new ones. We talked about the incoming governor, Ned Lamont, and what we can assume to expect from him. Before we go, you mentioned DECD under Catherine Smith, and they got a lot of heat in September because their numbers weren't accurate for the auditors and how much money the state was actually pulling from these deals?
You know, we have a saying in the economics writing business. This is that numbers are always fungible. And I think in the end, that report by the auditors is going to, it certainly is, I have no reason to believe it's inaccurate. But the problem with trying to pin down jobs and the number of jobs created is that it's really, I mean, I've tried to get numbers from companies, and I get that I'm not giving them millions of dollars with contracts, but it's really hard. Are you talking about full-time jobs? Are you talking about total jobs? Are you talking about FTEs? And there are lots of ways to analyze it. The bottom line is that these deals are a shockingly small number of jobs in an economy with 1.7 million jobs, right? The total number is in the few tens of thousands, which is a few percent of Connecticut's jobs for all this money. The question is whether it creates enough of a of a catalyst to jumpstart the economy in Connecticut, whether the jobs are off by some or not, and that is being looked into. And I think the DECD has already said we're doing things differently. The state is not in position to stop doing something that's an established catalyst for job creation.
Dan Harrigan, we'll tweet out your latest column at Where We Live, columnist and associate editor of Hearst Connecticut Media. Dan, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me, and have fun talking about it. It's a little early in the day for wild turkey, isn't it?
Speaking of which, do you like dark meat or white meat?
Oh, boy. I used to be dark meat, and I've moved to white meat.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. That's Dan Haar. And coming up, we're going to talk about Thanksgiving or Turkey Day for some of us who really look forward to eating the large bird. Coming up, we're going to hear about how wild turkeys actually disappeared at one point from the state of Connecticut. You can join us, too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We know turkeys are synonymous with Thanksgiving and most of the birds raised on farms for holiday dinners. Two-thirds of them come from just six states. And while domestic turkeys or farm-raised turkeys are often preferable to eat over wild ones, at one time there were no wild turkeys left in Connecticut. Do you have not a gaggle, not a flock, but rather a rafter of turkeys that hang around your neighborhood? For more on their return to our state, joining us by phone is Michael Grigonis. He's a wildlife biologist with the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection and had worked on Connecticut's wild turkey program. Michael, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
So we know turkeys are a symbol of our country, especially around Thanksgiving, when we think about Thanksgiving dinner. Tell us, though, about the wild turkey that most of us see in our neighborhoods and what caused them to go extinct in our state.
Well, a wild turkey is a very majestic bird. It can fly over 50 miles an hour and run over 10 miles an hour. It has been in our state since its native species to the state of Connecticut, and it disappeared, and the last documented bird was about 1813, and after that, the bird had disappeared from Connecticut, and it wasn't until 1975 that we reintroduced wild turkeys from New York. We got 22 birds from New York State that were truly live-trapped wild turkeys, and they were released up in Great Mountain Forest. And since that time, those birds have done very well. We conducted another 14 releases across our state and brought of 356 birds to various parts of the state, and the turkeys are doing very well. It's one of the greatest wildlife management success stories that we have.
So just to go back, Michael, so when they disappeared from the state of Connecticut in the 1800s, that was due to habitat loss?
Primarily. Back in the 1600s, when Europeans first settled the state of Connecticut, about 95% of the state was forested. By the 1850s, that was down to about 34%. And because of loss of forested habitat, those birds were pushed into smaller and smaller pieces of habitat, which made them more vulnerable to predation, disease, and of course, the farmers in the area were utilizing them as a food source as well.
And so the wild turkey program that started in Connecticut, the father of the turkey program, I understand, was Steve Jackson, and you brought in turkeys from New York State.
That's correct. There was Allegheny National Forest right on the New York-Pennsylvania line, and that's where Connecticut first obtained their wild turkeys. All the other releases in the state of Connecticut were birds that were rocket netted in our state and then transferred across the state into suitable habitat.
And when they were reintroduced, how did it go? Were there years where there were less baby turkeys, or what parts of the state actually where you saw the population flourishing?
From the 1975, it started slow, but the birds, they took off pretty well, and they got to the point where we could trap those birds and move them around. Through the 80s and into the early 2000s, the Connecticut's turkey population grew exponentially, and from 2000 to present, we've had a little bit of decline, but the birds are doing very well across the entire state.
So well, in fact, that there are still there are now turkey hunts in Connecticut.
Yes, we had established our first turkey hunting season. It's a spring season in 1981, and 428 permits were available that year. And that's the number of hunters, and they harvested 21 turkeys. The wild turkey is not an easy wildlife species to harvest.
And why is that?
They have excellent eyesight, excellent hearing, and have the ability to respond to danger in a blink of the eye.
I understand that this reintroducing the wild turkey back to Connecticut is one of the state's greatest conservation stories, but any lessons that state biologists have learned from this particular program that could help with conserving other animals in our state?
Yes, one of the things, research is very important, and initially with the wild turkeys in the state of Connecticut, biologists felt that the wild turkey needed 6,000 contiguous acres of forested habitat to survive. And we now know that that's not true. We see turkeys in our neighborhoods all the time. So you have to study the birds and find out what their needs are. And over time, you adapt your management strategies to those needs.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and I'm curious, we do hear about stories where turkeys harass certain neighborhoods, and that's because of human behavior feeding these turkeys, Michael?
Yes, quite often. I will get up on my soapbox a little bit. There's enough food resources in Connecticut's woodlands that it's not necessary to feed turkeys, and there's two very good reasons not to feed the turkey. One is sometimes they get habituated to people, and they will create nuisance situations where they actually get aggressive towards people. The other thing is when you feed turkeys at a bird feeder for an extended period of time, there is a greater chance that disease can be passed from one bird to the next, and that's never good for any wildlife population.
When a nuisance turkey does come across a neighborhood like in Stamford in the last few years, what happens? How does DEEP get involved?
We try to work with the homeowners in the neighborhood and have them first remove any food source. And usually that will cause the problem to subside. Also, we have the homeowners harass the birds and make them feel unwelcome in the area.
You have the humans harass the turkey.
Yeah, that does work from time to time.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Gregonis, who's a wildlife biologist with the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. He worked on Connecticut's wild turkey program to bring back the wild turkey to Connecticut due to habitat loss. They left, but they were able to reintroduce some wild turkeys from New York State. Before we let you go, because Thanksgiving's this week, can you give us one turkey fact to stump our relatives, Michael? Something we don't know about the turkey.
That they have the ability to fly over 50 miles an hour. A lot of people don't know that.
That's a pretty fast bird then, right?
Yes, it is. Yep.
My 3-year-old told me that baby turkeys are known as poults.
That is correct.
And then one last question for you, Michael. Do we know why we call a group of turkeys a rafter?
I'm not familiar with that term. I usually call them a flock.
A flock. Well, yeah. We want to thank Michael Gregonis for playing along with us at the end, a wildlife biologist with DEEP. Thank you for your work.
Thank you for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. Thanks to our technical producer, Kion Wolf. Also, thanks to Lydia Brown. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about the pressure that are on middle and high school students to get good grades, to be involved in extracurriculars. Do you think kids are getting too much pressure to succeed today? We want to hear from you. That show coming up tomorrow. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. As always, thanks for listening.